5 minutes past 7, and time now here on RTE Radio 1 for The Book Show.
This is The Book Show with me, Sinead Gleeson. Get in touch by email bookshow@rte.ie or find us on Twitter and Facebook at bookshowrte. On this evening's show, science is on the side of readers everywhere as we find out how reading literary fiction can actually make you smarter.
It can improve your theory of mind, your understanding of what another person is feeling, and that's quite extraordinary.
But first this evening, J.P. Dunleavy. James Patrick Dunleavy is a New Yorker who came to Dublin, where he studied science in Trinity nearly 70 years ago. Throughout his career, he's been in the Navy, he's been a boxer, a successful painter, and most famously, a writer. He wrote The Ginger Man, his best-known work, as well as dozens of novels, including The Onion Eaters and The Beastly Beatitudes of Balthazar Bee. He now lives just outside Mullingar, and I went there to visit him. Okay. Hello there, hi.
Hello.
Is that Levington there, the house?
It's Dunleavy's. Have you ever heard of Dunleavy's?
That's the very one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's the old writer, or whatever you call him, historian, Dunleavy. It's a big old castle. It's just the entrance into it there.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Oh, pretty imposing gates. Let's see if we can... Kind of rusted into shove, does it? Oh, there we go. Heavy. Okay. A long driveway and lots of big trees. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, how are you? I'm
very good. Dunleavy's secretary Deborah meets me at the door of the house and shows me in.
Oh, I'm covered in moss and rust.
I'm sorry,
wow,
yes.
Lovely to be here. Gorgeous.
Rather chilly, but we're going to stay in the kitchen.
This is a very big hole.
It's a very big house. It's a very big house. Follow me into the kitchen.
Great. When I arrive, JP is tending the fire in the kitchen as his publisher, secretary and son chat in the background.
Hello.
Good to see you again.
Yes, good
How
to see you?
You.
Well, I hope I'm all right.
Unsurprisingly, he's slightly overwhelmed by a crowd of visitors.
Well, this is the biggest social occasion in 20 years. So, I'm learning how to cope with it.
It's early in the morning, isn't it? Just
That's five punches in a second, so that's what I try to keep up to.
Are you an early riser? Would you
Not
be up from early?
Terribly. I just go to work when I want to feel ready to do so. Or indeed, I don't make it a work sort of thing. I just let it take its own course.
Dunleavy is in his late 80s, but still very active and spends most of his time here at the house at Levington.
But you can see there's the lake is out there.
Oh, beautiful.
And this goes down to the lake shore. So it's a wilderness.
How far is the lake from here, distance-wise?
Well, it'd be about a mile.
Do you get down to the lake much?
Yes, I make myself go down because of a pleasant walk. But you, in this house, you cover several miles before lunch. Simply because of the size. It goes around in two wings and so on. And it's hard to believe, but it has an indoor Olympic-sized swimming pool inside this house, just like this kitchen is.
This house has a pool inside?
That's right, a swimming pool.
Some of the rooms, including the swimming pool, are closed off, but Dunleavy's affection for Levington is clear.
Nothing has ever been cut down or destroyed. No tree, no bush, nothing.
How do you feel about the idea of preservation, even in terms of the house? Because the house looks very much like it's been like this way for a long time. Is that important to you?
Oh, yes, this has never been touched. This is the old sitting room for the servants years ago. And on the other side of the wing across there, that houses the actual kitchen, the original kitchen, which was a great big, large place with a great fireplace and so on. So the house has been pretty pleasant to live in all these years, and we keep it as best we can to stay that way.
It would be a big job, I'd say, to renovate as well, just in terms of if you wanted to paint this house, because some of the paint is crumbling away. And
It's a bankrupting business.
And why did you come here first? What attracted you to it?
Well, I came to Ireland. I'm a New Yorker. That's very rare customer. I grew up in New York, and I remember after the war, they had the GI Bill of Rights, and you could pick any university you wanted to go to, and they paid for it, you see. And so my mother, having come from Ireland, and my father, I asked them, were there any universities in Ireland? And luckily, my mother said, yes, Trinity College. And so I wrote off to them, and I must have been a novelty of sorts, so they just said, come on over.
Dunleavy used to be a boxer and fought, amongst others, Raging Bull himself, Jake LaMotta. Hanging here in the kitchen is a photo.
Yes, the heavyweight of the world.
It's of Dunleavy with Joe Frazier just before Frazier's big fight in 1971 with Muhammad Ali.
And I had a punch that they were all fascinated with. And it was like U.S. Western rattlesnake. It would come, I can show it to you. It's an arm that's sort of loose. Now, you can't even see that, but that punch had gone all the way over and gone like that, you see. But you can't even see it. There's three of them, practically.
You still got some power in that arm.
Yes, that's right. And you close. Your fist is to open. Your fist is open all the way until it reaches that point. You couldn't throw the arm that fast if it, your hand wasn't sort of open, if you had it clenched tight. But I remember at Trinity College, the boxing team would come and implore me to join the team. But when they came along to make known their sort of wishes, they all, their noses were flattened over their faces, they had black eyes. And I said, God, I'm not going to join that boxing team.
What was Trinity like in those days, the people who went there, the geography of it? What kind of place was it?
Well, it was, it's hard to describe in any way because it had its own description. You couldn't really find another place just like it somehow. I couldn't, and people who came to see Trinity never talked about, oh, this is just like Oxford or something. No one ever drew that kind of thing. And it was always looked upon in this way of its ancient background.
Dunleavy's infamous novel is The Ginger Man. When he tried to get it published almost 60 years ago, it was nearly impossible.
It was almost, you'd have to say, unpublishable. People wouldn't publish it. It wasn't something that could be published. And it was Brendan Behan, of all people. He had come out and was, as he would do, is go and visit people like that and sort of eat their food and everything else and roam around and do all sorts of, wild matters. And I put him in charge of my cottage, which was way isolated out in Wicklow on the sea, and left him there to look after everything while I was away for about 3 days. And I've discovered that being took all my shoes had disappeared. Americans carried around a lot of shoes in those days. I might have had 40 pairs of shoes. I would say golfing shoes, made to play golf in. So you'd have six of those, that type of thing. But I said, Bean, where are all my shoes? And they all seemed to be gone. And he said, oh, I tell you what, Mike, he said, I hate my feet getting wet. I hate the countryside. I hate country people. And I wanted to get to the pub to have a drink as fast as I could, keeping my feet dry. So I took a great big bag of all your shoes and wore them until they got wet. And that would be about 30 yards across the field, and throw them back into the field, put on a dry pair. And I got to the pub with my feet dry. He actually did this.
So he wore out your shoes, basically.
Well, yes, I went to collect them then.
So how was he involved with, you know, helping you to get the Ginger Man out into the world?
Oh, he was the one who sat and read the manuscript, one of the first people ever to read it, in the my studio. I had a little garage that had been converted into the studio, and all my papers and books and manuscripts were there. And he picked it up and read it. He was the first to ever read it. And I couldn't imagine that he was even interested, but he was an author himself, and you soon found that out, and interested in writing. And he did say this to me, and it sounds a little pretentious to hear it said now. He said, Mike, he said, that book of yours is going to go all around the world. I was amazed that Pian would even say that, but he was absolutely wrapped up in his writing and everything and so on. And then he said to me, he said, I see this manuscript. He said, I know there's a publisher in Paris who would publish it because everyone turned it down. And because it was too scatological, if that's the correct word. And so finally he said, there's a publisher in Paris called the Olympia Press.
It became a kind of long-term relationship with you with Olympia. What happened when you got involved with the press itself in terms of buying it out later down the road?
He published it in a manner which I thought was derogatory, if that's the correct word, simply because he made it like a dirty book. And that infuriated me. And so I got very angry and sued him, in fact. And we had just back and forth suing each other, back and forth. It went on for the longest time until I was able suddenly to secretly, in an auction, the Olympia Press went bankrupt. And my then wife, I think, went to Paris. She knew a bit of French and to attend the auction. And she bought the company. So I found myself in this extraordinary situation of going to Paris, forgetting that I had bought the auction, and I was suing the Olympia Press. And my lawyer said, Mr. Donnelly, I think we should do something with this matter. And I said, what's the trouble? He said, well, you are suing yourself. And you own the company, and you're suing them. And so we think we should settle.
Dunleavy has been a painter as long as he's been a writer, and all through the house there are scores of paintings hanging and stacked around. JP brings me on a tour of the house.
Show us down the corridor, I think, too. Is your art all over the house, or do you have it in particular rooms or sections?
Well, let's see what happens. Here's a dining room, I think. And here, let's see if this goes on. Oh. Yeah.
Lots of shutters. Wow, it's a...
This is the most fossilized piece of black marble known, evidently, by anybody. But it's the only one that's known anywhere. The Knight of Glynn, who loves to follow these things up, used to come along here and sit in the seat and try to count them. He never succeeded.
I can nearly stand up in this fireplace, almost. It's so big. Have you had this as a very big deal as well? Have you had over the years many interesting guests?
Well, over the years, in recent years, not really, because one doesn't socialize so much. It's not used. We must use it again because it's pretty cold in here. Here we go this way. The good thing about this, it has 11 bathrooms, so it's very comfortable in that regard. And I'll show you this room in here, which is a manuscript room. And it's complicated, as you can see.
This is where you keep your original manuscripts? Or?
Well, yes, a lot of are in those boxes there, are those original manuscripts. I have them very well looked after. But this floor here now is about 6 inches thick to make certain that no dampness can come up out. And so it's tiled like this to seal everything. Is sealed underneath this, so there's no dampness underneath the books here. All my manuscripts, everything is accounted for. And
and my eye is drawn to the shelf here to a pink spine and a purple spine, both the Fairy Tale of New York.
Oh, really? Yes. I wouldn't even know what some of the books are now.
The last room we visit is the sitting room, where Dunleavy sometimes
Does
works.
Does this room have any other writerly connection for you? Because when we came in the door the other end, I noticed there's a bust of James Joyce on the piano.
Well, nothing more than someone gave me that as a present, the James Joyce bust, because they knew James Joyce were in this house and stood at the door there because Joyce himself describes doing it. And his father was something to do with the some measurement firm or the local town, and they came here to visit and see this man here, and Joyce wrote about it himself.
So Joyce was in this very sitting room?
Yeah, he would have been standing in this room right where that bust is, and he refers to it himself, Joyce, and was looking out that door into the garden at the time.
It's perched on the piano. Do you still play the piano?
Yes, I do.
Do you?
I don't know whether the piano works, but it might.
Nicely done. And thanks so much to J.P. Dunleavy for inviting the book show into his lovely home. We've put a list of some of his best known books on our website on rte.ie, but my recommendation, and it's a book I've bought for several people over the years, is The Ginger Man. But now, what would happen if you were to read Chekhov?
The police superintendent Otrumielov is walking across the market square wearing a new overcoat and carrying a parcel under his arm. A red-haired policeman strides after him with a sieve full of confiscated gooseberries in his hands. There is a silence all around. Not a soul in the square.
Are you feeling smarter? What about if you read this?
Olivia Grayson sat in the chairman's seat at the board meeting, listening intently to the presentations, her intense blue eyes taking in each member of the board. Her eyes were quick and sharp.
That was Danielle Steele there, which was clearly popular fiction and for fans of guilty pleasure reads. According to a study by Emmanuel Castanos and David Comer Kidd in New York's New School for Social Research, reading literary fiction over commercial fiction does actually make a difference. Here's Emmanuel Castanos on the distinctions between literary and popular fiction and what it can do for you.
One of the possible ways which you can think about this distinction is that literary fiction, the focus in literary fiction tends to be on the mind of the characters. They tend to be complex, incomplete, unfinished, contradictory. And there is a lot of work that the reader is required to do by the author in order to make sense of them. And perhaps you never quite make sense of that person. And in a way, it's more... It corresponds more to what the reality is. Human beings, that's what we are like, you know, very difficult to make sense of. And so all this effort that is required, we think is critical in producing the effects that we observe in our experiments. Roland Barthes calls this kind of fiction writerly fiction, because he calls it that way because he thinks that the reader is almost required to co-write the piece as he or she reads it, and it distinguishes from readerly fiction, which we equate to popular fiction, where the reader has a more of a passive role.
That was Emmanuel Castanos, but joining me now in studio to discuss the benefits of reading, scientific or otherwise, are writer, broadcaster and avid reader Moncon McGann, and also joining us is Dan Hurley, the author of Smarter, The New Science of Building Brain Power. Dan, this book is about a lot of things, including how reading can make you smarter, but what kind of intelligence do we get from reading?
So reading, like many other activities, is definitely associated with improved general abilities. And I got interested in this because when I was 8 years old and in school, I still couldn't read. And I can remember the moment when my teacher, Mrs. Browning in Whittier School, pointed to a word and said, "Okay, read that." And I said, "Tahi." And she said, "No, that's the." And that was the moment, I can still picture it, when I learned to read the word the. And I was labeled a slow learner. And 3 years later, though, I was a straight A student and ever since have done pretty well. And what happened in between was that my best friend started reading Spider-Man comics and became obsessed with them. And I realized that I was going to lose my friend if I didn't join in. And so I started reading. And as far as I can see, that is the only thing that changed that opened my cognitive abilities.
Superheroes made you smarter is what you're saying, basically.
Well, you know, I think that there are many things that we see smart people doing that it's not just by chance that they often play a musical instrument or that they like chess or that they read a lot. These are actually things that are associated with intelligence. And when randomized clinical trials have been done to see if you can actually improve someone's intellectual capacity, the group that plays music or does physical exercise or begins doing these complex games can improve.
Moncon Magan, I don't know if you play music or if you're a big chess player, but I know you're a big reader. Do you think your emotional intelligence has improved by being a reader?
I hadn't thought about it until, you know, Dan brought up the subject. Like, I have the exact same memory as he does with regard to the, except his is a fond memory. Mine was my grandmother couldn't not believing that I couldn't pronounce the. And I was also a slow reader. And I finally got into The Robber Hotzenplotz, this series of books. And I always knew that reading gave me company, you know, it made me feel less of an isolated loner. There was a whole world out there. But I hadn't thought before all those other things it gave me. That, like, when I started reading Steinbeck, you're suddenly dealing with all these multi-complex moral quagmires that, you know, a young Dublin boy otherwise wouldn't have to grapple with.
But, I mean, we're all talking about books. We all love books. Dan, we know people who don't read, and of course they're still intelligent and smart, but what about those people who don't like reading? Do you think they're missing out, and does it affect their intelligence?
So there are many roads to the same place, and people that prefer math, math is, we all know, a great way to stimulate your mind. There's physical exercise. So people that, especially children and older adults who are still active and aren't just sitting on the couch, can definitely improve their abilities. There's a method, I think, for everyone. Reading is how I discovered my passion for you know, thinking and intellectual work, but there's many different routes. And it's not just, you know, academic, pointy-headed, nerdy stuff. We're talking about the ability to carry out your daily activities, to succeed in life, to enjoy yourself, and get along with others.
Moncon, is there something specific about the idea of book smarts? Because we know people who are, you know, not necessarily the most charismatic, interesting people in the world, but they read a lot. Are book smarts everything? Are they different?
So, you know, it all depends what books you're reading, doesn't it? Like, the worry I have, if one chooses to read open-minded, aware, sort of, you know, wide perspective books, then does that develop your mind? It did me. You know, I had never, like, experienced Africa until I started reading Evelyn Waugh and saw it through his prism, or Karen Blixen. But of course, I was then getting their mindset on it. So it's hard to know, you know, you widen your mind every time you read a book. So you get this level of book smarts, but then you also are being funneled into a particular propaganda element. So there was two sides. So I think the more you read, you do eventually build up smarts. First, you're just funneled down all sorts of paths manipulated by the author. And you read enough of them, you start arguing with yourself. Wait there, if Waugh has one idea of Africa, and then if Ben Okri has another, and you're dealing which story is the true story. So eventually it develops into, hopefully, some sort of Weltanschauung, some sort of worldview.
Dan, obviously the brain is a muscle. It needs to be exercised, and you make that case very strongly in the book. Is it specifically being exercised by literature, by books, rather than reading anything else?
Absolutely. This wonderful study that was published in Science found that it can improve your theory of mind, your understanding of what another person is feeling. And that's quite extraordinary. And I think anyone who's ever read James Joyce or Flaubert or any of these deep writers, we all begin to learn things about other people's emotions that we might not have suspected. But, you know, it's a circular thing. So some of these methods that can improve your abilities actually make you a better reader and better able to comprehend what you're reading. So there are kids and adults who have a hard time grappling with certain books, and being able to do some of these tasks and learning some of these methods can actually open your ability to understand and enjoy what you're reading.
Briefly, Moncon, is there a sense that even if we've, you know, that idea of comprehension that Dan mentions there of being a better reader, do you think no matter how much you've read, we've ever read enough or we can know enough?
We've all been, mostly we're reading white, middle-class, well-off people. I'd love to read people, the voices from all the rest of the world who haven't been writing books until now.
Thanks to Moncon McGon and Dan Hurley. Dan's book, Smarter, The New Science of Building Brain Power, is published by Viking. To finish, we talked to the street and asked some people what they feel books have done for them.
I've read since I was a very small child, and I think that my vocabulary really was greatly widened, although it's not evident now.
Gosh, I've learned everything from books. I love to read. I read every chance I get. I never watch TV.
Well, I wouldn't say it makes you smarter. Well, it always depends on what you're reading. But at the same time, you're going to keep to your own preferences, so you're not really going to grow there with intelligence if you're just going to stay in the same genres all the time.
It enlivens the imagination.
And anyone that doesn't read, you can know by them, because you'll mention what's going on, whether domestically or in worldwide, and they won't have a clue about it. And you say, isn't that an awful pity? How much enjoyment you would get from reading.
Well, I'm actually a writer myself. I write poetry and stuff. Reading is makes your brain bigger and sharper, so you're a better listener. Turns you into a better listener.
I do find by doing crosswords, reading the paper, increases my vocabulary, that's for sure.
I read a lot about relationships, and I've learned a lot. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this in radio, but there's a book like Why Guys Love Beaches, and it teaches me a lot. It teaches me that, I don't know, how to like go on with guys in a good way.
I think reading transports you into your imagination, and it just expands your mind. So when you do travel or you encounter people from overseas, or it just gives you something to talk about with people, complete strangers like you and I. We're now talking about reading.
And that was Liam Geraghty there, talking to people in Dublin about how reading has affected them. That's all we've time for on tonight's show. Next week, we'll take a look at the short story. But tonight's book show was produced by Zoe Cummins, and we'll leave you with Regan Hutchins and a footnote on Virginia Andrews.
In 1986, Virginia Andrews, the author of the teen incest classic Flowers in the Attic, died of breast cancer. Her publisher, Pocket Books, hoped that her genius would be an immortal one and immediately hired a ghostwriter, Andrew Neiderman, to seamlessly mimic her gothic family sagas. 27 years on, Neiderman has finally spoken about his ghostwriting, leaving fans divided on the issue. However, it does keep them guessing at which of her novels Virginia Andrews actually wrote.
The book show was presented by Sinead Gleeson. You're tuned to RTE Radio 1.